and for the October calendar. And I would like to welcome, on behalf of the court, students from Amherst High School. Would they please stand? Good morning. It's good having you here. Please be seated. The students are here with us with a program sponsored by the State Bar in this court. The program is called Court with Class, and high school students from around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they are given materials about the case, including the briefs, and then as part of the program, we'll visit with a justice of the Supreme Court after this argument. And these Amherst High School students may be joined by Franklin High School students or the University of Wisconsin pre-law students. Today, the justice with whom they'll meet is Justice Bradley. So let me introduce Justice Bradley and the court to you. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice David Prosser. The far left is Justice Lewis Butler, the newest member of our court. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. And to his immediate right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, we will call this case 03-1850, Jones Soley et al. Versus Employee Trust Funds Board et al. Representing the Employee Trust Funds Board is Assistant Attorney General L. Jane Hamblin. Ms. Hamblin?
As the Chief Justice said, I am Jane Hamblin. I'm an Assistant Attorney General who's here today representing the Employee Trust Fund Board and the Department of Employee Trust Funds. This case is a certiorari review of two decisions of the Employee Trust Funds Board, where the board held
Excuse me, Counselor, is there some way you can lift the mic up a little? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Certainly. Is this better?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit better. Thank you very much.
I'll also try to speak up.
Yeah.
This is a case of certiorari review of two decisions of the Employee Trust Funds Board in which the board found that Soley and Baxter had been properly placed into the formula group of the state teachers retirement system by the board that governed that system at the time, that they were entitled to creditable service under the formula group for their teaching experience as combined group members when they became formula group members, and that they waived all of their formula group creditable service when they took a final separation benefit from that group in 1971. The circuit court reversed the board's decisions. The board appealed. The Fourth District referred the case to the Third District because of a conflict, and that district of the Court of Appeals has certified it to the Supreme Court because it states that the Supreme Court should be the court to decide whether the Schmidt decision from 1990 should be construed to provide continued membership in the combined group to teachers who withdrew their deposits.
Counsel,
yes.
If I might just interrupt you for a moment. I did not participate in the Schmidt case. Concern that either my husband or I would somehow be affected by the decision. So I would like to know from you, if possible, would a decision by this court affect employees who were on the teachers' retirement system in the 60s, who did not leave service, but extended service until retirement in the 90s, or in 2030, which is my plan.
This decision in this case would not affect...
Could you read that question, please?
Yeah. An announcement, yeah. Yeah. We were wondering.
Premature. Go ahead.
My response is that this case would not affect a teacher who never took a separation benefit.
Okay, good. Thank you. I will continue to sit under those circumstances.
Counsel, as long as you brought up the Schmidt case, and I'm sure you'll have many other questions on it, but it seems to me in Schmidt, where they said that there was credible service, and they said that this was under, there the person was already part of the formula group. Here, and the waiver was different. Is that the primary, if you're making a point, at least what I could see, that the primary difference is that the waiver that was signed by Baxter and Soley in 1971 had different language. In other words, the language was, the additional language was, and they're waiving, and to any benefit arising under any provision of 42-20 to 42-54. Is that the major difference, is the wording of the waiver?
Your Honor,
and the difference in circumstances?
Your Honor, that was the major issue in Schmidt.
Yes.
As to what was the definition of, pardon me, as to what was waived when someone took a combined group separation benefit. In this case, that is not the issue.
Right.
In this case, the issue is were they correctly put into the formula group when they were hired back as teachers,
right,
after the formula group was created?
Does your prefatory comments seem to focus, before you ask any questions by the court, seem to focus our attention on Schmidt, the case Schmidt, and how it should be interpreted? Did I hear you correctly?
I regret that that was the inference. I mentioned Schmidt because that is the focus of the Court of Appeals when they certified the case, because they stated that they couldn't decide whether Schmidt was actually applicable here. And in fact, I only learned yesterday that there was a Court of Appeals decision issued last year in a tax case, not in a pension case, where they were asked to decide whether Schmidt applied to the question of membership, and the Court of Appeals in that case said it is not applicable to the question of membership. And that is not referenced in my brief because I only learned of it yesterday. And that case is the Camps versus the Department of Revenue case. And as I said, I raised Schmidt simply because that was a focus of the Court of Appeals.
I've looked at Camps, or a part of Camps, and it seems to me the court in Camps was relying on, discussing the Schmidt case, and relying on a standard of review that perhaps was wrong. It relied on the standard of review of granting some deference to the Wisconsin Department of Revenue. Tax Appeals Board. And said, with regard to that level of deference, well, Schmidt can be interpreted in a couple of ways, the Camps Court said, and the interpretation by the Tax Appeals Board was reasonable. And then they came to their conclusion. But last year, this court came out with a decision that I think would undermine the Camps analysis. We issued a decision called Beecher, B-E-E-C-H-E-R, It was a workers' compensation case that dealt generally with what is called in workers' comp as the odd lot doctrine and focused on the Labor and Industry Review Commission's interpretation of the Balshefsky case. Okay? So that's all my preface. Bottom line is this. This court recently said, look, when we're interpreting a case, we owe no deference to an administrative agency's interpretation of our case. It's de novo, period. Yet when I look at the Camps case, it seems like its analysis is driven on the question of how do you interpret Schmidt. It's saying, well, the Tax Appeals Board had a reasonable interpretation, so it seems like they're applying a wrong standard of review, which is a level of deference to arrive at their decision. Can you respond to that, or are you not able to, given that...
The way I read Camps, and again, it was regrettably only yesterday, but the way I read that was that they were interpreting Section 71 of the tax code.
051A.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that is where they were giving deference to the Tax Appeals Commission's interpretation of that statute. When it came to Schmidt, I don't recall that there was deference given, and in fact, as I recall, the court said basically Schmidt could be interpreted either way, but we don't think it's applicable to this particular case. And in fact, I would argue...
I think you're right with regard to that.
And I would argue that that the Court of Appeals is exactly right, that the Schmidt case is not applicable to an interpretation of whether a person was a member, that you must look at the statutes themselves. Those statutes that define member were not at issue in the Schmidt case.
Mm-hmm. But it does raise still for me the question of whether a board can determine the issue of whether or not a case applies when there are arguments on both sides. I mean, do we owe any deference to that board's determination regarding the applicability of a case? Isn't that a legal determination that we can do?
It is a legal determination, and in fact, the standard for a legal interpretation is de novo review for the court. However, the courts do give various levels of deference to the interpretations of agencies, particularly agencies where the legislature has granted the authority to administer a certain program, as is the case here with the retirement system, because not only the Employee Trust Fund Board, but it was the former State Retirement Teachers Board that made this determination that they should be, that Baxter and Solee were not members on September 11th, 1965, and thus they were not allowed to elect to remain in the combined group and were properly placed in the formula group, which then led to their taking a formula group separation benefit in 1971.
Well, is this a long-term interpretation of the ETF?
It is a long-term interpretation. It was an interpretation that was applied not only by the White Trust Fund Board, but by the STRS. In many cases where the question of deference is involved, agencies are able to cite to previous decisions where they have interpreted a statute. Unfortunately, because there is a statute that requires all decisions not to be made public, the decisions of the Employee Trust Fund Board, unless they're appealed to court, there is no such record that I can present as evidence. The only evidence that I can suggest is that because there were thousands of teachers who, with respect to whom this decision had to be made, we know that the STRS and subsequently the ETF made these decisions, and it appears that they've been consistently made because of Baxter and Solee, plus the other cases that are in the pipeline that have been put on hold until this decision is concluded.
So this decision is affecting how many people?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I do not.
Well, you said you were talking about former decisions affecting thousands of
Former decisions as to who would have been a member.
Right.
As to this particular decision about people who had taken a withdrawal of their deposits from the combined fund, I do not know how many people that is, but the decision as to membership, the statute in general, certainly was made to each person who was a teacher whenever the formula group came into effect.
Well, would you have to go back and recalculate everybody?
If
you should,
yes, they would have to do that. However, the ETF has had to do that. They went through and recalculated everyone when the formula group came into effect, because at that point people actually had creditable service. There was no such thing as creditable service during the combined group. And whenever there is a decision, as there was in Schmidt, that they had misinterpreted statute, then they do go back and recalculate everyone's benefit based on that.
Can you make the link for me that I'm having trouble linking on my own? You're talking now about membership, talking about whether or not the teachers were properly put into the formula group. Does that depend on whether or not they're entitled to this credible service? In other words, does membership depend on that?
Membership did not depend upon creditable service. It gets very confusing, I think, because Chapter 42, which governed the teachers' retirement system, was initially adopted in 1921. Excuse me. It was amended many times until 1957, when the combined group was added. Then the formula group was added in 1965. So you have a very complex statute which is trying to address three different retirement plans for some people who actually have some benefits under all three plans. It uses some of the words in different ways. Creditable service is a clearly separate term, which means only creditable service under the formula group, which was used as a factor in calculating the defined benefit pension that was payable under the formula group. Under the combined group, which is where Baxter and Soley were participants prior to the formula group, there was no concept of creditable service. There were two concepts. One was the deposits. The state and the teacher both were required to make deposits into the retirement deposit fund, which was defined in the statute to be the fund which was set aside for the deposits, and it was the board was required to retain money in that fund that were equal to the liabilities for those deposits and their accretions. Any earnings were credited to that account under the statute. Any capital gains and losses were credited to that retirement deposit account. That was the case from 1921, from when the system first began, onward. There was also teaching experience, which the boards were required to keep track of. Now, it may be puzzling that in a money purchase system, which was what the separate plan was, and the combined plan were both money purchase systems, which means that you only get an annuity based on what the deposits in the retirement deposit fund will buy. Why are they keeping track of teaching experience if there was no impact, if there was no creditable service formula? You have to go back and look at the separate plan statutes. The state, under the separate plan, was required to make a contribution that was equal to 50% of the teacher's required contribution plus 5% of that amount for each year of teaching experience the teacher had, not counting the year that they were for which the deposit was being made. That is why they originally started, they were required every year to calculate the teacher's experience plus the amount of deposit, and then figure the deposit for the state that was required to make, and then submit that to the state treasurer. In addition, under the separate group, there were provisions that a teacher who had taught, in some cases 25, in some cases 30 years, could get an increased amount of an annuity So they had to track how many years of teaching service. If there had been 25 or 30 years, they would get a certain increase in their annuity. When the combined group plan became effective in 1957, however, state deposits were not dependent upon teaching service. The state was required to deposit only the same amount as the teacher was required to deposit into the retirement deposit fund. Some teachers in the combined plan were allowed to get the benefit, the extra benefit based on long years of service, but only if they had been members of the separate group. If they had been a member prior to April 1st, 1957, neither Soley nor Baxter fall into that category. When they were in the combined group, their deposits, the state deposits and their benefits were solely a factor of the money that was on deposit in the retirement deposit fund. So it then makes sense that member was defined by whether there was money in the system for a person. There is nothing in the statute that says that the teaching experience that was recorded on the record, credited, if you will, to a teacher's record or account, was deposited somehow or credited somehow to the deposit retirement fund. And that is the specific term that is used in the definition of member. It doesn't say there was a credit in the retirement system. It says if there is a credit in the retirement deposit fund, then they're a member. It also has two other qualifications which do not apply here if someone has a reserve in the annuity fund.
What's wrong with interpreting credit to include this idea of creditable service? I don't understand what's in opposition to taking that approach.
Creditable service, recall, creditable service is only a concept in the formula group. We're talking about what these people waived while they were in the combined group before 57.
They want to be continued in the combined group, right?
I beg your pardon?
They want to be continued in the combined group.
They want to be continued in the combined group.
Their claim is that they were forced into the formula group. They didn't want to be there. Is that correct?
That is what they claim now, Your Honor. That's right, in this case, that they should have been permitted to elect to stay in the combined group. But they also argue that the reason they should have been permitted to elect is because they were members on September 11, 1965.
And they were members because they were entitled to some creditable service.
But they were not entitled to creditable service because there was no such thing as creditable service in the combined group. If the formula group had never been adopted, if they had never returned to teaching after the formula group was adopted, they would never have had creditable service. They withdrew their deposits. They waived the state deposits. Yes, Schmidt says that they retained their years of teaching service. The statute called it teaching experience. You're credited with teaching experience. It did not call it creditable service because there was no creditable service in those terms. So when they left teaching as a combined group member, they took out their deposits and the interest. They waived their rights to the state's deposits and the interest on the state's deposit. They had only left in the combined group these years of teaching service, which were not creditable service. They did not entitle them to any benefit under the combined group. Had they never returned to teaching, had the formula group never been adopted, there was no benefit that they could have expected or been entitled to from the state teacher's retirement system. When I stated in the brief that they severed their relationship, it was from the combined group. There may have been, in retrospect, an inchoate right to subsequently get formula group creditable service based on this teaching service, teaching experience that they had accrued. But the teaching experience was unrelated to a benefit under the combined group, and that is the issue as to whether or not they were members on September 11th, 1965.
If they're in the formula group, am I correct? They don't get credit for prior teaching experience up to the last time they came on board?
No. When they became, when a person becomes a formula group member, or became, they were entitled to receive creditable service under the formula group for their teaching experience, not a year for year, because that's what Schmidt says. You get, even if you took a withdrawal of all your deposits as a combined group member, you still retained your teaching service, just on the record. So that when you become a formula group member, that teaching service then provides the basis for formula group creditable service. But if you took a withdrawal benefit under the combined group, you only get half of creditable service. This is what Schmidt says, and it's not really relevant here, but you don't get one for one. You get a certain percentage of your of creditable service for the years that you spent teaching as a combined group member.
Now, you're just so I understand, there are several categories, and my question, there is one called inactive. In other words, if a person puts teaching but keeps his money, he doesn't draw it out as these two people did. Is the plaintiff seems to make the argument that so that there would be no difference. Maybe I don't understand it, but there's no difference between a person who quit teaching, took their money out, and a person who quit teaching but left their money in as far as credible service. If I misinterpreted that?
Once a person becomes a formula group member, there is no difference as to whether you took your money out or not. That's exactly right. That is what Schmidt says, that if you waived your money, you did not waive your teaching service. But that teaching service only provided a right to a benefit under the state teacher's retirement system once you become a member of the formula group. Teaching service for a combined group member like Baxter and Soley, who had not ever been members of the separate group, was not a factor in any benefit that they would have received under the combined group.
Could I ask, during the 1965 session of the legislature passed something on creditable service. Were either of these plaintiffs in the system at the time that legislation was passed?
They were not in the system when the legislation, well, the date in the statute is September 11th of 1965. They were not, I think that's part of the issue here today. They were not, I argue they were not in the system. They were not members because they had no money in the system at that point.
They had been in the system.
They had been in the system before.
They terminated and drew their money. Okay.
And waived all rights to the state's deposits.
But that's the issue.
Yes.
But it's different in the Schmidt case, isn't it? That prior to September 11th, 1965, didn't he come back as a combined member?
Exactly. He did. Mr. Schmidt returned to teaching as a combined group member before the 65 Act became effective. Therefore, when it became effective, he had deposits in the retirement deposit. So he, but then he elected to become a formula group member. This issue was not even on the table in Schmidt. There was no issue about whether he should have been a formula group member or a combined group member. The only question there was the separation benefit he took as a combined group member and whether or not that waived his teaching experience such that he did not get creditable service for it when he became a formula group member. The board doesn't dispute that finding. The board found in both decisions that both Baxter and Soley were entitled to receive creditable service when they became formula group members for all of their teaching service as a combined group member. The question is, when did they become a formula group member? And under the statute, if they were not a member of the system in September of 1965, They did not have a choice to join, they did not have a choice about joining the formula group. If they became a teacher, became a member after November 30th of 1965, they were automatically placed in the formula group. Now, even though they had been teachers before, even though he had been in the system before, that participation, that membership, had ended. They were not members when the formula group was adopted, and thus when they were hired again after the formula group was adopted, after November 30th, 1965 is the date in the statute, they were properly put into the formula group directly, and at that time they received creditable service for all of their teaching services combined group members. They lost that when they took their 71 separation benefit.
Let me ask this. Assuming your view of the facts, in the 1965 session, when the creditable service concept was created, why couldn't that legislation be applied retroactively? Is there any reason why it couldn't?
Retroactive, I'm not, could you explain that a bit, retroactively to?
Why couldn't it go back to people who had served previously, even if they had come out of the system, so long as they come back in the system?
They could have made that provision. The legislature could have provided that everyone had a choice. The legislature could have provided that anyone who had ever been a teacher was a member of the system. But they didn't. In terms of making the formula group retroactive, there were teachers who didn't want to join the formula group. And that's what Soley and Baxter are now saying, that they didn't want to join the formula group. In terms of making creditable service retroactive, that's exactly what the statute attempted to do, I believe, by saying you're entitled to receive a certain amount of creditable service with respect to your years of teaching service before, because your years of teaching service before were not important in terms of the amount of benefit you received as a combined group member, as a separate group member they were. But because you've had this teaching service, we need to find a way, the legislature said, to give you credit for that, to give you creditable service for those years of teaching. And that's what they did. In a sense, that was making it retroactive, but they did not make the whole group retroactive because there were people who didn't want to join the group. Am I answering your concern?
If there's a certain retroactive effect to the legislation, were the school districts required to put in money to cover that retroactive effect?
In terms of whether there was creditable service given for time where they had taken out their... No, in fact, the Department of Employee Trust Funds used to refer to it as free service. They certainly worked for it, but it was only if... Well, as you recall, the state didn't lose money when they took a withdrawal benefit. The state's deposits remained in the system. However, once a person took a formula group withdrawal benefit and lost all of their rights to their creditable service, if they came back to teaching and they wanted to have that creditable service, then they had to put money back in the system with respect to that creditable service. But for those people who were made formula group members and had taken a withdrawal as a combined group member but received creditable service, I do not believe that there was any additional contribution that was required.
So what you want here is an affirmation of the board's position.
Yes, Your Honor, to find that the Soley and Baxter were not members on the required date, that they were properly put into the formula group, and thus when they took a separation benefit in 1971, they waived all creditable service to that date.
Thank you, counsel. You have 4 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Is it Houston? Joanne L. Houston. We, Wisconsin Education Association Council, representing Jones, Soley, and Ann Beck. Counselor, before you begin, would you put the mic down kind of so it's mouth level for you? Yeah, you can either lower the table or just bend the microphone. Yeah, we've had trouble with our sound system, so thank you very much.
May it please the court, I am Joanne Houston. I represent plaintiff respondents Joan Soley and Ann Baxter on behalf of the Wisconsin Education Association Council. And if I could ask the court's indulgence, I have a hearing problem, which makes it hard for me to distinguish sounds, especially in an echoing environment. So if you wouldn't mind speaking loudly, I'll be more likely to hear your questions. The argument presented by the Attorney General is one that has been made earlier in other cases, and the arguments have been rejected in other cases, as you know, having read the record. This case really is not very complicated, and in contrast to counsel's statement with regard to Schmidt, it is our position that Schmidt absolutely controls a determination as to whether or not a combined group member retained rights in the system following a combined group separation benefit, and in holding that those members did retain benefits.
Now, you say that in your brief, which indicated that this has been asked and answered many times, that if we were to decide in favor of the board, that we would be overruling certainly the Schmidt case and maybe Benson. Aren't the facts here different? I mean, the facts in the sense that in Schmidt, he was already part of the formula group and he elected to go into that. Here, we have people who, at least twice, and these are both Baxter and Soley, decided that they would not teach, drew out their money, and then signed these various waivers, the last one being signed in 71. So it would seem to me that now the waivers are different. We understand that than the one that was signed in the Schmidt case. I believe I'm correct on that. So the question here is one, whether or not they were members of the State Teacher Retirement Service, and you make the point that, well, look, they were inappropriately put into the formula. I mean, they should have stayed in combined because it reverted back to 1965, but we don't have to overrule Schmidt if we were to decide in favor of the board, do we?
I believe, though, that the result would be an overruling of the holding in Schmidt. The reason is that in Schmidt, the court held that the narrow combined group waiver, which was signed, waived money only. This was a brand new concept to the Department of Employee Trust Funds at that point. Now, it's true that Schmidt did not define what other elements there were to be waived. However, in finding that there were other rights retained, it presents the question then, what were those rights retained following a combined group separation benefit.
Yeah, these rights, credible service, whatever.
Yes, one of the
rights. They only exist if the teacher took the money out and went into the banking business, for example. We just had a banking case before this. There would be no question. They wouldn't be eligible for anything. It's only that they came back into, quote, state service teaching that they reestablished this, in quote, well, this term service. In other words, I've been a teacher for 10 years. I quit, and I was out for 4, and now I'm coming back, and I want credit for that service when I retire. But that's the only time. And what the board is saying, as I think, is that, look, they weren't members during the time they were out, and therefore they would not get that credible service. Maybe I've made it too simple, but I'm trying to – this is a rather it's complex in the sense of understanding all the different time factors here and understanding what credible service is.
You know, it's – kind of confusing to look at that September 11th, 1965 date as determinative of Baxter and Soley's rights under the system, because it is really the plain language of the statutes governing combined group withdrawals as interpreted by this court in Schmidt that governs their continuing rights under the system. Now, Schmidt held very clearly that the narrow waiver of the combined group withdrawal indicates that there are other rights retained. And Benson, the appellate court in Benson, emphasized that point. And Benson actually stated that those creditable years of service are one of the rights retained under the retirement system. It is our contention that you're absolutely right. The question is, did the combined group member, such as plaintiffs, who took a withdrawal, retain any other rights of membership, more particularly the right to elect entrance into the formula group when they return to teaching after the formula group was created? I would also like to clarify another issue that was raised in the Attorney General's argument, and that is the issue about whether creditable service had any meaning prior to the creation of the formula group. The court in Schmidt held that it did. It held that at page 43 of the decision and in the appellant's appendix at page 171, I feel like I'm back in the classroom saying if we could all turn to page 171. I was a teacher for a long time, so it's kind of familiar to me. Schmidt said that creditable service for years prior to July 1st, 1966, when the formula group became effective, is determined by looking at the statutes and rules applicable to the member at that time to determine whether the number of years of service as a teacher that have accrued are theretofore creditable to the member under the new formula group system. It went on to say that a year prior to July 1st, 1966, a year of teaching experience was defined as a fiscal year during which the teacher was employed as a teacher, not less than a full school year. If the teacher made the required deposit when due for each year of service as a teacher, then the corollary to the code provision in existence at the time provided that a year of teaching experience would be credited to that teacher within the retirement system.
I just have a question. If they didn't make the required deposit, and maybe this is, I'm thinking of another situation, the person could still buy, couldn't they still buy credible service from the board?
In other words, if they never made a required deposit.
Well, if they didn't make some, you know, in the beginning, let's say they decided they.
Arguably, no. In other words, once they made the required deposit, they were they were then given the right to have that year of service credited to their account.
Right.
If they never initially made a required deposit, then they would not have ever become members of the system. What the only thing that is required to be a member of the system is to make a required deposit.
And so then it makes no difference, your argument is, whether once they became a member, once they put the money in, if they took it out, they still retain that, quote, membership. That's what you're saying? That they would retain, in other words, once they made the deposit.
That's correct. Okay. Nothing in the statute states that money must remain in a member's account in order for that member to retain benefits, rights to benefits in the system. The statutes only require that a deposit be made. Subsequently, the statutes provide for separation benefits, and the legislature was well aware that people would take separation benefits in the formula group statute itself. It referred to that, and it talked about how teachers will be considered to have engaged in separate periods of teaching when they, EA, have taught, have not taught for longer than 2 years, or B, have taken a separation benefit. So if a person took a separation benefit, a separate period of teaching could constitute less than 2 years, whereas otherwise a separate period of teaching would exist only if they were out of teaching for more than 2 years. There's no mention in that statute with regard to whether or not they lose membership. It refers to members, and it refers to the members receiving a benefit from each separate period of service, that each of those periods of service be used to determine the final average compensation.
Counsel, does the record in this case reflect what difference it makes which group they're in? In other words, talking about Ms. Soley for a moment, does the record reflect what the monthly benefit difference is depending on whether she's okay in the combined group as against the formula group?
I'm sorry, the first part, does it make a difference as to?
The monthly benefit, if they're in one, the combined group as against the formula group, what difference does it make for her? Is that in the record?
I believe it's in the record in the sense that the formula group benefit is a defined benefit plan which provides which provides pension benefits based on three factors: the final highest average salary for the final 3 years, or the highest average salary over 3 years, the number of years of teaching experience, and then a numerical factor. Whereas the combined group benefit was a defined contribution plan where the members put money in, and whatever money was there was used to purchase an annuity. So it was much more related to the amount of money in the system. The distinction that you raise here is very important, because when the formula group was created, this created a whole different type of benefit for teachers in Wisconsin than they had been experiencing. In fact, it was so different that the legislature required that the state issue a notice to all teachers teaching at the time to let them know about this change, and it gave specific timelines by when choices had to be made by teachers, whether they were going to remain in the combined group or enter the formula group. In entering the formula group, the teacher undertook a great deal of financial risk, more so than when they were in the combined group, because a teacher who took a separation benefit under the formula group waived all right to any benefit under the system, whereas teachers who took combined group separation benefits waived nothing other than the money, the state share of money in their account.
Could I ask, if a teacher was a member of the combined group and withdrew the money and never came back to teaching, were they Are they members now?
Arguably, yes. But in order to activate that benefit or in order to receive the benefit, they would have to have returned to teaching.
So theoretically, if someone left teaching in 1964 and took a job today, if they could get a job, they would qualify under your for the creditable service going all the way back?
Mm-hmm. According to the statutes governing teaching experience back then, yes. People who left, but they would have had to return to teaching in order to collect that creditable service benefit.
But that which they did before September 11, 65, is that reduced by one half?
Yes, that's correct. The amount of creditable service that was that they were eligible for was defined by the legislature to equal either a full year or half year of credit. The issue is that no creditable service was available if they never taught and made the initial required deposit. Now, the Assistant Attorney General attempts to equate membership with money remaining in the account and to equate all benefits in the system with having money in the system. This interpretation is contrary to Schmidt as well as to the plain language of the statutes. In Schmidt, the court held that a teacher who withdraws money waives the state deposit accumulations, nothing else. This holding was the first one that rejected the board's interpretation that an STRS member only had the right to a benefit in the retirement system if his money remained in or was replaced in his account. Similarly, in Benson, the Court of Appeals held that a teacher became entitled to credit for years of teaching service upon the making of a deposit to his account and retained that right regardless of whether any money remained in the account. Again,
I just was thinking about the question that Justice Prosser asked. I said about the person that taught for, I said 10 years, but you can make, then went into another profession, I said banking. So under your argument here, you could teach for 10 years, draw all your money out, go into a 30-year banking career or whatever, go back into teaching, and then be eligible for the creditable service, even though all your money was out back from 1960 to 60, whatever, you can pick the dates.
That's correct. That is the determination in Schmidt. It said that under the plain language of the statutes, money is not required to have a benefit in the retirement system.
Well, what's the difference between someone that left their money in, say, became inactive, took another career, they'd be the same then, wouldn't they? Whether they left the money in or
That's correct.
Service is divided
in terms of the timing of the withdrawal and so on. But it is true that if a person withdraws their combined group separation or their money as a combined group member and another teacher does not withdraw that money, that both of them retain the right to the creditable years of service in their account when they return to teaching.
But the teacher who did not withdraw the funds will, on retirement, get more money.
Yes, because the money, well, in the combined group world, that's correct. Because there, the money itself went to purchase the annuity. In the formula group world, it's the years of experience that provide the increased pension benefit.
So is your answer to the Chief's question yes and no? I mean, does it make a difference whether you left the money in versus the person that took it out and still gets the same credit under the formula plan?
When the formula plan was created then, teachers who entered the formula group plan either by election or by operation of law in 1973 had creditable service in their accounts if they were combined group members and had made an initial deposit in the system at some point after 1956.
Even if they drew the deposit out.
Even if they withdrew that deposit.
Right.
That is what the narrow statutory waiver provides in terms of the combined group. The legislature also recognized that when it created the formula group and assigned that group a much broader waiver of any right to all benefits under the system. So it's true. It sounds sort of unintuitive, but that is the correct reading of the statute. And that is exactly why the board contends, I believe, that this doesn't make sense to them, because in their view of the world of retirement funds and retirement benefits, money is the sole determining factor with regard to benefits.
But here, in the waiver that they signed in 1971, unlike Schmidt, they signed that they would waive any benefit arising out of any provision under 4220 to 4254. So that is different.
True. The plaintiffs did sign the broader formula group waiver at that time, but only because they had been automatically placed in that group without making an election by the board when they returned to teaching.
But they weren't teaching when they were in other words, in 65, they weren't around teaching. So they were put in when they came back in 67 and 69. Those are the dates that they came back
in. They weren't teaching at that time. But it is our contention that they remained members because each of them had creditable service credit in their account.
Can I ask you a question about a document that was in the record? And I don't know, if you don't know it offhand, I can understand that. But what I'm looking at is an Exhibit 11 offered January 23rd, 01. It's a notice to employers, and it speaks to some of the issues that seem to be part of the board's case. It says, new teachers who have never been members of the state retirement system automatically come under the formula plan. Then in the next paragraph it says, teachers who have previously been members but have withdrawn everything in their accounts automatically come under the formula plan when they return to teaching and meet the requirements of teaching at least 50% of the normal full-time teaching load. Does that have anything to do with any issue we have to decide about when they became a part of the plan? And this document dated March 1967. Do you know what I'm talking about?
And that was a document produced by the board, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. The significance of that issue is that the board refused to acknowledge and has refused to acknowledge the existence of the statutory section that applies to plaintiffs in particular when the formula group was created. There were three ways to become a member of the formula group. If you were actively teaching, you would make an election between September 11th and December 1st of 1965. If you were on an authorized leave of absence, you would make an election upon your return to teaching after that leave of absence. Now, what the board does is it skips directly to D and says anyone else is obviously a new member because they didn't have money in the system. What that does then is it makes Section C surplusage, and the statute I'm referring to is 42244, creation of formula group election by members. It's on page appellant appendix 143. And there are four provisions there. And C reads, any member who is a member of the system on September 11, 1965, but who is not eligible for an election under A or B. Okay, this would have to be a person who is not actively teaching, is not on a leave of absence. Who does that leave? Now, the statute could have said that with C, it could have added the provision that anybody who isn't covered by A or B and has not taken a separation benefit can elect to join. under C. Anybody who took the separation benefit would be under D then. But the legislature did not make that exclusion pertain to people who took the combined group separation benefit.
So your answer to my question is really this document is contrary to what the statutes provide, so it really doesn't enter into our decision-making about the question you've presented. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thanks
That's
a lot.
Correct.
Let me make sure I understand your argument also as a follow-up to Justice Wilcox's question regarding the signed waiver. It's your argument that any signed formula group waiver is irrelevant or not part of the analysis. I'm asking if this is, if I have your argument correct, because they were not members, in your argument, of the formula group. They should have been properly members of the combined group. So any subsequent formula group waivers are void ab initio. They have nothing, no bearing here, because the real question is the threshold question of were they properly placed in the group. And if you say yes, they were properly placed in the group, then you give relevance to the signed waivers. If you say no, they were not properly placed in the group, then those waivers are irrelevant.
That's exactly correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
And if I could follow up, your position really boils down to the fact that your clients should have been given a choice in 1971?
They should have been given a choice when they returned in 1966 and 67.
All right.
It was then that they were automatically enrolled in the formula group without an option to decline that enrollment.
On page 143 of the appellant's appendix, you're relying on 42.244.1C. Is that correct? But now that wasn't the law when the plaintiffs left the system.
When the plaintiffs left the system as combined group members, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, that's true. That's true. It wasn't the law when they left the system, but that doesn't change the fact that they retained rights as combined group members. I mean, they had years of service remaining in their accounts after they left prior to September 11th of 1965. Those credits in their accounts constitute sufficient benefits in the system to equate to membership. In other words, the creditable service credit, contrary to the board's argument, creditable service credit is well sufficient to satisfy the definition of member under the statute. Members are the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Creditable service credit that you rely on, where do you get that prior to the passage of 42, 244, and 245?
Yes, in Schmidt, the court observed that under... At page 43 of the Schmidt decision, appellant's appendix at 171, the court observed that prior to July 1st of 66, a year of teaching experience was accorded to a teacher when they made their initial deposit into the system. The fact that the creditable service concept had not yet been invented does not serve to nullify the existence of those years of service in people's accounts. Those years of service existed apart from creation of the formula group. All the formula group did was to provide a form of benefit using those years of service. So the fact is that the years of service remained in the teacher's accounts under Schmidt, Benson, and the entire line of cases. The years of service qualify the plaintiffs to continue as members of the combined group. After all, they faced the same sort of dire consequence from a formula group separation benefit as any other combined group member did in the form of the loss of all their previous years of creditable service credit that they had earned at the time that the formula group was created. And that's exactly what happened to the plaintiffs in this case. They were, unbeknownst to them, automatically enrolled in this other retirement plan, and when they took their next separation benefit, having engaged in episodic periods of teaching since they began teaching almost 6 or 7 years before, the plaintiffs then took their separation benefit in 1971 and suffered the dire consequence of having lost all credit for all of their previous years of service. There is no evidence that they were ever aware of that, because they had been automatically enrolled. Whereas under the for combined group members who actively taught or an authorized leave of absence or not covered by either of those, they were required to have been given an informational pamphlet by the state so that they made a clear, voluntary, and informed choice.
Well, they were only aware of it when they, I mean, it's in bold type in 71, but what you're saying, they didn't know what they were signing, is that?
Well, basically, they didn't know the import of what they were signing because no one had explained it to them. All that happened was that had they been credited with membership in the system as they should have been, they never would have been enrolled automatically in that formula group upon their return to teaching in 66 and 67. Then they never would have signed that final separation benefit. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Kel.
Could I ask,
Justice Prosser,
what is your best estimate, if you prevail here, how many people will be affected by this decision?
It's very hard to tell. At this point, I know of about 35 people who are in a similar position, and it's important to note that the board has agreed to apply the outcome to people who meet the criteria that the parties have agreed upon should any benefit accrue from this litigation to them. It could be as many as several hundred. I have no way of knowing because there is no way to search records to determine who all may have been affected. It's only if they make us aware of them themselves that we find out that they're there.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Hamlin.
I'd like to comment briefly on Counsel's reference to dire consequences of becoming a formula group member. Actually, the formula group was a defined benefit. It was a much better plan for teachers than a defined contribution plan. And had they remained in the combined group and never become a formula group member, they would have never had been entitled to a pension because under the combined group you had to have money in the system to get a pension. So to become a member of the formula group was actually an advantage for them. As to whether or not they could have received notice of that, because they had taken their money out of the system as combined group members, their names were not even on the system's list. They were not considered a member of the combined group because there was no prospective benefit or obligation to them under the combined group. So that's why the statute required the SDRS board only to send notice of the implementation of the formula group to members.
Counsel, I just wanted to make sure I understand this. The definition of member then, in effect in the 1965 statute, was 40.26R. That's
correct.
Right. Thank you. And as I read that, you are a member if you have funds in the account, or, and this is the part that I'm emphasizing, may be entitled to a present or future benefit under the teacher's insurance and retirement laws provided by 4251.
Your Honor, that the teacher's retirement and annuity system under 4051, that was the system prior to 1921. And if you look at section 4051, I think it says that. But that particular system that
the teacher's insurance and retirement law was the system, the predecessor system to this teacher's retirement system. It was no longer available to new members after 1921. But there were, at the time that this was passed, there still were some teachers who had taught before 1921. So if they were entitled to a benefit under that pre-1921 statute, then they were a member.
How does Schmidt interplay with this definition? Schmidt, at least in part, saying there are benefits other than just money in the account. Your years of creditable service are a benefit. How does that Schmidt interpretation mesh with the definition of member under 6R?
Schmidt never said that the teaching service was in the teacher's deposit fund. I mean, the teacher doesn't have a special, there's not a concept of account under Chapter 42. The monies were deposited into the fund, the retirement deposit fund. And that is what the definition of member refers to. What Schmidt says is that by signing the waiver under the combined group, you didn't waive everything in the system. You waived only the state deposit accumulations, and you retained, in the Schmidt case, the only thing that was at issue was the teaching service for which they subsequently received creditable service under the formula group. So to say that Schmidt, to extend Schmidt to say that it defined a right to a continuing membership in SERS for the rest of your life, whether or not you ever return to the system, so that then every other provision in Chapter 42 that required the SERS board to send notice to a member, whatever, had to go to people, even though they'd taken their money out and gone into banking and had never returned to teaching, is not what is called for in the statute. It really is the money that was deposited, that had the credit that they had in the retirement deposit fund, and Schmidt did not speak to that. It spoke only to the fact that you didn't waive your teaching service, which could, if you went to the formula group, would become formula group creditable service.
So this turns on the word credit in the definition of member.
It also turns on the word fund, on what is the retirement deposit fund, and where in the statute there might have been any provision for crediting retirement, crediting teaching service to a fund, where the word fund implies money.
Doesn't it also turn on whether we're talking about a teacher being hired versus rehired?
No, Your Honor, it does not, because once the teachers were no longer a member, then when they came back, they were considered a new member because they'd taken a separation benefit.
Well, that puts an issue in this case, isn't it?
Yes, that isn't it. Yes, yes.
Thank you, Ms. Hamblin. That concludes our hearing on 03-1850, Soli versus Employee Trust Funds Board. And we want to thank both lawyers for an excellent argument on difficult statutory interpretation. The students should remain here for a meeting with Justice Bradley. And does the court want a half hour extra?
Yeah, I'm going to be.
2 o'clock?
No, it's 1:30.
We'll meet at 1:30 in the conference room. Unanimous vote on that.
I was hoping to.
You're not going to meet at 1:30? No, 1:30 is what they want.